I'm Chris Williamson. I'm the former Labour MP for Derby North. I was a Labour Party member for 44 years before I was targeted by the witch hunt. I was Jeremy Corbyn's loudest advocate inside the parliamentary Labour Party. I toured the country promoting democracy in the Labour Party and democracy in the economy, wanting to give grassroots members greater say over who they selected as their members of parliament, who was the leader of the party, also in terms of policy as well, but also in relation to ensuring that we could then use that as a platform to democratise the economy, because the economy worked in the interests of the 0.1%, and I was very keen to change all that. And as a consequence of those positions and the anti-imperialist stances that I took, particularly in relation to support for Palestine, I was targeted by the Zionist lobby, by the kind of neoliberal right-wing lobby outside and inside the Labour Party, and ultimately was suspended. And then I resigned from the party just before the 2019 general election, when I was dropped as the official candidate for the party about 4 weeks before the election took place.
Now, look, Chris, there was something very interesting going on in the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. You actually saw in your party one of the greatest increases in membership ever, actually. I mean, obviously, there was quite a lot in the early part of the 20th century and just after World War II as well. But you saw an enormous leap in membership. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think Jeremy awoke the country, really. I mean, socialism was a dirty word before Jeremy Corbyn got onto the ballot paper to become the leader. And what that revealed was that there was a huge appetite for a socialist and an anti-imperialist agenda in this country. I think people are sick of the elites in this country rigging the economy. I think they're also sick of the imperialist wars that Britain has been involved with, really, throughout its entire history, but obviously more recently with things like Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. And that scared the living daylights out of the establishment. And I think in particular, it wasn't so much the domestic agenda, although that was unpopular, obviously, with the elites in society. But I think it was Jeremy's anti-imperialist stance that was the thing that really frightened the horses, as it were, and they used every dirty trick in the book to destabilize him, to undermine him, to undermine his supporters, and I was a victim of that. The disappointing thing was that Jeremy's leadership, Jeremy as the leader himself, didn't do enough, in my opinion, to stand up to these negative forces that were ranged against him.
Yeah, and you were a victim of that, really. I mean, I think it was Neil Clark that wrote what I thought was an excellent column in his RT column, saying that Jeremy had treated his enemies better than his friends. I mean, that's a fatal mistake in politics, surely.
Well, that's an interesting comment, actually, because as an old Jewish guy said to another Jewish friend of mine, Eliane Green, it was also somebody who was suspended, but this elderly Jewish fella said, the problem with Jeremy is he's treating his friends as his enemies and his enemies as his friends. And I think what he meant by that was this comment, really, that you just mentioned that Neil alluded to in his column. I think a view was taken by people around Jeremy, and Jeremy went along with it. And I think it was against his better judgment, but he went along with it all the same, that the thing they needed to do was to try and manage the parliamentary Labour Party and to stop the party splitting. And frankly, I think if the party had split, it would have been the best thing that could have happened. And indeed, on the day that I was suspended, I'm told that Ed Miliband rang Jeremy Corbyn and said that unless I was suspended by the end of the day, 30 MPs were going to walk. Now, Jeremy should have said, well, be my guest. I think, frankly, most of them wouldn't have walked because, from my experience, the Parliamentary Labour Party are a bunch of careerists, and the last thing they would want to happen to them is that they lose their cushy lifestyle, the lucrative salary and the opportunities that affords people who are that way inclined anyway, both to actually use those that position whilst a member of a parliament, but particularly afterwards to then go on to get lucrative positions on company boards. And we certainly saw that with, many of the new Labour aficionados are, very involved in right at the centre of the private sector that's engaged in sort of privatizing the public realm in this country. You know,
that winter 2019, well, at the end of 2019 general election, was just a few years after. Well, I mean, the context of it was there was a kind of deadlock in Parliament over Brexit, and Jeremy was kind of keeping like one foot in both camps with Brexit. And I think there was, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what your take is, Chris, but it seemed that he was being a bit, you know, it was clear that there was a majority in the election, not a great big majority, but, you know, what the public are like, once a vote's been taken, that they want this implemented. And do you think that was a factor also in, why Jeremy didn't win that election, because he decided not to get behind the referendum?
Absolutely, that was a fatal error, and indeed something I counselled against very strongly inside the Parliamentary Labour Party and privately as well. I mean, my position was that, look, the decision has been taken. I mean, I campaigned for Remain, a Remain and Reform proposition, the same as Jeremy did. On reflection, I think I was wrong to do so. I think if I had the time ever again, I would have campaigned for Leave, actually.
Chris, why have you changed your mind?
Well, because I don't think the European Union is capable of reform for a start, and it is. And I think Jeremy acknowledges, and that's why it was the reform, you know, Remain and Reform agenda. It is a neoliberal club. I mean, Tony Benn made this point, many, many years ago, you know, the Treaty of Rome and so on. There's a kind of presumption in favour of capitalism, and it got worse. All the treaties that have been signed thereafter, you know, there's a presumption in favour of privatisation and a sort of ratcheting process going on. And on that basis, I just think that, you know, we and I made this point at the Parliamentary Labour Party and used to get shouted down for my troubles, was that, look, the best thing that we need to do as a party, when I was a member of it still, is to accept the outcome of the referendum, as happened in the 2017 general election. And I made the point that, look, whether we leave with or without a deal, it's kind of irrelevant, really. Even if we're left without a deal, I was making the point that all the economic forecasts stated that the economy would continue to grow. But I said that wasn't the big issue anyway, because, you know, we've had we've got the fifth biggest economy in the world, but we've still got 14 million people in poverty inside the European Union, as we were at that time. And the point I was making is that what our agenda should be is that we will respect the will of the people, we'll use the flexibilities available to a currency issuing nation like the UK is. We have our own sovereign currency, and that we would engage in a process of redistribution of income and wealth, and that any economic shock, such as it was, we would offset through a big fiscal stimulus. And I was making the point that, you know, even if there was a retraction in the size of the economy, and frankly, I didn't think that would necessarily follow, because the government could intervene and deal with any economic shock. But even if it did shrink a little bit, we could still lift the living standards of the 99%. And I was making the point, that's what the Labour Party should be all about. But, you know, I just was not listened to, got shouted down, and Jeremy went along with that nonsense. And this was against Jeremy's better judgment, let's be honest. I mean, Jeremy was a well-known Eurosceptic throughout his time in Parliament, worked very closely with Tony Benn, and supported Tony's position on the European Union, opposed all the treaties Jeremy had, and in a very sort of articulate and coherent way. It wasn't just a kind of knee-jerk anti-European position. He was making a kind of a reasoned case against membership of the European Union and against, these treaties which were diminishing our democracy in this country. That was his position all the way up to becoming the leader and then the referendum. And, you know, and I guess he went along with the sentiment inside the Parliamentary Labour Party and probably inside the party as a whole. I think there was perhaps a majority in favour inside the Labour Party, a cultural sort of bias, I suppose, if you like, towards Europeanism inside the Labour Party. And, you know, Jeremy went along with that. I mean, and it was Angela Riegel who said that, even though she turned against him, that during the course of the referendum campaign, that she doesn't know where Jeremy gets his energy from. He's got the energy of a 20 that would wear out, I think she said, or exhaust a 25-year-old, you know. So, you know, Jeremy certainly put the effort in. He put the miles in. He spoke at numerous meetings. And in the end, you know, the referendum was lost, and you have to accept that. But the Parliamentary Labour Party were not prepared to do that, and they used it as a wedge issue. That was the key thing for me, as we've seen now. because Sir Keir Starmer is perfectly okay now with Brexit, it seems.
Under Keir Starmer, things have changed drastically within the Labour Party. I mean, the bodies have been piling up, not just your own, Chris, but, you know, obviously Jeremy himself, people like George Galloway a long time before, Ken Livingstone, an absolute potential leader of the party, for example, someone that stood against the Labour Party in London and won, which is a very difficult thing to do. So what do you make of Starmer and the new regime?
Oh, well, the Labour Party's lost. It's always been a tool of the establishment. I mean, you know, the scales have fallen from my eyes, really. I think now looking back throughout my entire period as a member of the Labour Party, which numbers 44 years. But I think really since the franchise was extended in 1918, it's always been a tool of the establishment. You know, that first Labour government and then, you know, the second Labour government under Ramsay MacDonald and even the Clem Attlee government. You know, the things that they did were good, obviously, and did improve a lot of working class communities up and down the country. There was a presumption in favour of, you know, addressing inequality. And indeed, I was a beneficiary of that. I mean, when inequality was at its narrowest, this was after, you know, 30 odd years of the post-war consensus. In 1976, I was an apprentice bricklayer earning enough money with my girlfriend, who went on to become a wife, and she was working as a telephonist in the local authority. You know, a couple, you know, just a young working class couple, but we were earning enough money to buy our own brand new 3-bedroom, semi-detached house backing onto a waterfront. Now, that is kind of impossible in this day and age to do. But those advances that were made as a consequence of the reforms that were put in place by the Attlee government have all been undone. And Attlee should have gone considerably further. Indeed, let's remember that Nye Bevan, you know, resigned from the, with Harold Wilson actually, resigned from the front bench when Attlee's government went back on, you know, a universal free healthcare system and, you know, imposed prescription charges, etc., in order to, they claimed, raise the resources or contribute towards raising the resources for another imperialist war in Korea. So, you know, it was still a very imperialist government. So its foreign policy was not good. It was that government that landed us with the, you know, with nuclear weapons. Ernest Bevin, I think, who said, if we're going to be a bomb, you know, I want a bloody Union Jack on it or something along those lines. So I think, you know, its imperialist position, its position in relation to militarism was not great. And even its domestic agenda, as I say, could have gone considerably further. The zeitgeist was in the right place, for example, to have abolished public schools. I mean, that would have been a thoroughly positive benefit for the country as a whole, because still today, you know, most of the senior positions in civil service, in industry, etc., are held by, you know, public school boys and girls. You know, that's not great, in my opinion, for a kind of, you know, kind of balanced society, really, in that sense. So,
well, I mean, we've seen something pretty extreme with Starmer, though, in that.
Oh, really? Yeah, absolutely.
For example, during COVID, we've had him actually really not opposing anything the government has been doing, not arguing against any of the, you know, shutdowns, the closure of many small, medium businesses, many people just out of work, not able to claim any kind of furlough compensation or whatever. And also now with Ukraine, and I'd like to move to talk about a bit about that now. The other thing is that the Labour Party is not opposing in any way this support for the Ukrainians, which I, you know, is interesting in that we're not, although they're not part of NATO, they're still getting our support. Apparently, even most importantly, probably is weapons. They're getting British weapons pouring in there since Christmas.
Well, I mean, you know, the Labour Party's lost. I mean, and you know, the veil has been removed. I said it was always a tool of the establishment. I mean, now it, you know, it's nakedly, it's open. I mean, I guess, was, you know, when all those years I was a member of the party, I was kind of content with crumbs from the table. But it's very much, of, you know, the war machine is very, very clear. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Labour Party, Keir Starmer and his cohorts, are now to the right of Henry Kissinger, for God's sake. I mean, Henry Kissinger said, look, if Ukraine was going to survive and thrive, it must not be on either side's outpost. You know, he was saying it's got to be a bridge between the two. You know, many eminent people on the right, you know, kind of, you know, US warmongers. I mean, you know, William Burns, a former CIA, head of the CIA, said that, you know, NATO expansion was a foolhardy proposition, that it would, you know, lead to civil war in Ukraine if it went ahead. You know, George Kennan, even, you know, the guy who formulated the policy of containment on the of the USSR, similarly said, you know, the expansion. I think he's, well, let me quote what he said, actually, if I can find it. Yeah, he said the expansion of NATO was the most fateful error of US policy in the entire post-Cold War era. It's astonishing, frankly, that you have a situation now where the Labour Party is to the right of Henry Kissinger and has banned essentially any criticism of NATO, which is not a defensive military alliance, it's an offensive military alliance. And let's also remember that Gorbachev was promised that there would be not one inch of expansion eastward after the reunification of Germany. And to see the Labour Party now falling over itself to, well, I mean, they're almost even more bellicose than Boris Johnson is. I mean, you know, this attack on free speech that we've seen in relation to the closing of RT. Well, I mean, Sir Keir Starmer was calling for that long before it came to pass, and long before the war in Ukraine.
Well, more importantly, started. He was calling for it before the government were.
That's what I mean. That's what I say. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the point I'm making. Yes. So, no, the Labour Party's dead. And, I, you know, look, our only hope now, I mean, look, I, you know, I was incredibly, maybe I was naive, but I was incredibly hopeful when Jeremy burst onto the scene, if I can put it that, he'd been around for a long time, but you know what I mean, burst onto the scene as leader of the party. We became the biggest political party in Western Europe. And Jeremy talked initially about creating a social movement and, you know, this notion of democracy. And that's what I sort of took on the road and it found, you know, huge support. I mean, I addressed huge meetings up and down the country. There was a massive appetite for this socialist, anti-imperialist, democratic agenda. And of course, you know, let's remember Tony Benn said that democracy is the most revolutionary thing in the world. And when I, you know, when I read that all those years ago, I kind of wondered what he meant really. And then I saw it for myself with my own eyes in terms of the way in which, you know, I was dealt with and, you know, the way in which, you know, democracy was absolutely crushed. This notion of expanding democracy was utterly crushed inside the Labour Party. And, you know, it's being crushed regrettably in the country as well. And I mean, to demonize the anti-war movement as being, you know, Putin apologists, you know. I mean, I've been myself referred to by erstwhile comrades, people who I've known a long time, actually. One guy, for example, who I've known for almost 40 years, a former, I thought, a good friend and comrade, refers to me as publicly as well, in a very kind of pejorative way, obviously, the 21st century version of Lord Haw-Haw. I'm regularly referred to as a Putin apologist, because I am saying we should not be supplying lethal aid, this euphemistic term, to send you know, weapons that are obviously going to kill more people, that we shouldn't be doing that, and that we should acknowledge the circumstances which led to this war erupting in the first place. All of those, you know, those quotations which I referred to with Henry Kissinger and the rest, you know, that explains where we're at. And, you know, this war could be stopped tomorrow. All that is required, and a very reasonable demand, it seems to me, is for Ukraine to put into its constitution that it is a neutral country, that NATO kind of pull back, and that we, you know, that we kind of demilitarize and we acknowledge the self-determination for the people in the Donbass region. And of course, you know, Donbass was originally Russian anyway. I mean, years ago, it was a representation, as I understand it, from after the revolution, from communists in Ukraine, urging Lenin to, you know, not, as it were, take back the Donbass into the kind of the Russian Soviet, but to leave it in the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. because they wanted, you know, some industrial workers. If they know, you know, we're left with these peasants.
Chris,
you know?
The Russians have charged in, all guns blazing, with something like 180,000 soldiers into a sovereign country, and they may not stop in Ukraine.
Well, I don't believe that. I mean, look, I've not got a crystal ball. I don't think that is the case. I think that the action, much as I wish it hadn't happened, which is as I, you know, deplore it. I don't want to see war, of course. I mean, I'm a peace campaigner. And I think maybe other economic and diplomatic measures could have been taken. But, I don't see this in the way of, in the same light as, say, the US-UK, the coalition forces going into Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, this is very much about saying that they're not prepared to tolerate, Ukraine becoming a member of NATO and citing nuclear missiles with a 5-minute flying time to Moscow. And we're giving very little time for any kind of retaliatory measure. So we're kind of undermining, if you like, that sort of mutually assured destruction notion that sort of, as it were, has kept that kind of uneasy, well, certainly kept me on an uneasy peace during the Cold War, as it were. But yeah, of course we deprecate war, but I think it's important that we understand the context to it. And I don't believe, time will tell, but I don't believe the intention is to, occupy Ukraine. But, you know, there's an interesting article that was written by John Denny in the Wall Street Journal in December, only December of last year. John Denny works for the Atlantic Council, which is a de facto think tank for NATO. And the article, you can Google it if you wish. If you just Google the strategic case for risking war in Ukraine, that was the headline. That was his article that he wrote. And I mean, basically, he was setting out a proposition, which was a win-win for the United States. He said that it would either, if they kind of kept sort of provoking Russia, it would either force Putin to back down, thereby undermining his credibility at home and on the world stage. And if he went ahead and invaded Ukraine, that was also a positive benefit for the US because it would forge a pro-NATO, anti-Russian consensus in Europe and enable the imposition of debilitating, I think he referred to them as debilitating sanctions, and, you know, embroil Russia, that is his hope was, embroil Russia in a guerrilla war that would sap the strength and morale of Russia's military and undercut Putin's domestic popularity. But of course, the other thing we need to acknowledge, I think, is that waiting in the wings here, the US corporations, capitalist corporations, who are rubbing their hands with glee, not just the military industrial complex, you know, Lockheed Martin, and was this potential, I think it's taken off the agenda now, but there was some suggestion, wasn't there, about Poland supplying MiG jets to Zelensky and then the US backfilling with US jets. I mean, yeah, you can just imagine the likes of Lockheed Martin rubbing their hands at the prospect of more bumper profits. But, you know, whilst they're flooding the country with weapons, that's obviously going to help the military industrial complex, but also, of course, the oil industry. One of the things that, you know, US were, you know, concerned about was the relatively low cost gas supplies and oil supplies, particularly gas supplies coming from Russia, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline and the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is now being effectively sabotaged. That then gives a huge opportunity to the liquefied natural gas industry in the United States to sell their gas to the European market with no competition from Russia. And these sanctions that we are engaged in imposing against Russia, I mean, they're not going to hurt the United States too much, but they will certainly and are already having a negative effect on this country. I mean, you have the ridiculous sight of Sir Keir Starmer saying the British people are prepared to make economic sacrifices, you know, to support the Ukrainian people. I mean, this is just nonsense.
Well, the Atlantic Council, Chris, I'm sure rubbing their hands about, is the what they would call propaganda victory of eradicating Sputnik and RT from our TV screens right across Europe. I mean, you know, they basically were giving the BBC around the world a run for their money. And in some parts of the world, their viewers were actually higher than the BBC. So they've basically beaten the BBC at their own game. And the Atlantic Council now saying, well, actually, no, RT's gone. I just wonder what you make of the media coverage, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about Julian Assange, and I'm thinking about what Britain is doing to him. We've just heard yesterday, this week anyway, that the Supreme Court here has refused to hear his case. Now, this is unbelievable in a way, because of the importance of the case, and also because Julian has not committed any crime under British law that they can pin on him. It's basically just the Americans saying, look, we want this guy, bring him back to Dodge. So anyway, just give us an idea of what you think of the media these days, because this is actually the only way the public will get to find out about what's going on. Of course, it's an extremely important pillar of any democratic society.
It is, and it's blatant propaganda. I mean, maybe it always has been, but I think that it is worse than we've ever seen it. I think it is a real blow against freedom of speech to close down RT and Sputnik, as you say. Absolutely, they want to silence these alternative voices. Of course, you can still get access to RT, and of course, you know, the other independent media channels on which we are speaking this evening, you know, to get an alternative viewpoint. But look, the media is still very powerful. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, Malcolm X said, you know, the media is incredibly powerful. It has the power to make you hate the people being oppressed and love the people doing the oppressing. And, you know, we're seeing now a kind of a very one-eyed view of the war in Ukraine. Of course, by all means, they should be reporting on the terrible consequences of war and shelling and so on. But what we're not seeing is from the other side. You know, why aren't they reporting from East Ukraine, you know, from the Donbass region? Why aren't we hearing about the impact of the Ukrainian military's attacks on the Donbass? And indeed, not just now, but, you know, since the coup that happened in 2014, aided and abetted by the United States of America, who spent around $5 billion on a regime change effort, which was ultimately successful. And, you know, around 14,000 people have been killed in those 8 years. And we know something in the order. This is from the UN Commission on Human Rights. Around 50,000 people have been injured as a result of Ukrainian military basically, you know, shelling their own people. A little wonder that Luhansk and Donetsk regions have declared themselves independent of Ukraine when they've been under siege.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because this idea of shelling your own people was a causus belli in Libya to literally send the tanks
absolutely
in. Well, you know, so idea if it's happening in Ukraine by our allies in Kiev, that it doesn't matter. But if it's happening, you know, just over a day or half a day, or even if it's just been on Al Jazeera and it was made up, that's a reason to go in. Anyway, look, I just want to drag you back to Assange, because I wonder what you make of what's going on with him. Do you think he'll be eventually extradited? I remember when all this stuff in Sweden started happening, the accusations there made by this woman who, by the way, after he had allegedly raped her, later on that day, she took a photo of herself with Assange saying, look how cool, I'm with Julian Assange, which is not necessarily the sort of thing someone who'd just been raped would have done. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is he was saying right back then, this is like 8 years ago now, maybe even longer, that the Americans wanted him, and that was what it was all about. And it looks like they may now get him, Chris.
Well, that is a tragedy, and it's looking increasingly grim, the prospects for Julian. One of the many things that grieved me when I was a member of Parliament was that I seemed to be the only member of Parliament that was prepared to speak up for Julian. I tabled a motion in support of him, and I think four other MPs signed it. That was all. Jeremy did make one statement, I think, on Twitter when he was dragged from the Ecuadorian embassy, and I think Guy Abbott made a statement in the House. But that was it. And you know, this is the most significant journalist who has done an incredible international public service, it seems to me, shining a light on the powerful in terms of the abuses of state power, but also the abuses of corporate power as well. You know, in this neoliberal era that we're in now since, you know, the Thatcher-Reagan axis of evil, if I could put it like that, you know, corporate power has increased exponentially. And to have somebody like Julian Assange, you know, exposing that, exposing war crimes and so on, you know, he had to be silenced. And what is unforgivable, in my opinion, is the silence of the political class in actually, you know, challenging this. I mean, one of the positives, of course, had there been a Corbyn-led Labour government, whilst I was making the point to Jeremy that we needed the democracy reforms, because if we got elected and he got the keys to number 10 Downing Street with the particular parliamentary Labour Party that we had, without the democracy reforms, he wouldn't be able to deliver his programme anyway. But one of the things we would have been able to do would have been to have released Julian Assange. And I think his legal representations are now, I understand, are going to move to the US as well to see whether there is scope to get the US Supreme Court to throw this out. I mean, Obama, when Biden was the vice president, had all but sort of given up on prosecuting Julian Assange. And obviously then there was a change in the presidency, and, you know, we know what's happened since. But it's an absolute disgusting travesty of justice, what's happening. I mean, we have a political prisoner in a high security prison in Britain, guilty of no crime. I mean, he was originally sentenced to a year, I think it was, for skipping bail when he sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. I mean, that's bad enough, actually. But, I mean, even if you accept that, his sentence has been served and he's not been released because they claim he's a flight risk. I mean, look, Britain is acting as the United States poodle. That's the top and bottom of it. And it's important, I think, that we continue to raise a voice. But, you know, I've criticised the political class, but I will also criticise the corporate media hacks as well, because where are they? I mean, this is one of their own, and they've been almost silent about it. Very few people, certainly in the mainstream media. I mean, they used and abused Julian for their own ends. You know, The Guardian in particular, I'm sure, increased its circulation when they, you know, used information that he supplied to them. But they've abandoned him. Not just abandoned. I mean, they've been sort of, you know, dancing on his grave almost, if I can put it like that. It's a truly disgusting state of affairs. It's a real stain on the character of Britain, actually. And, you know, we have to keep hope alive. We have to keep fighting. He has huge support, I think, you know, whenever he would have even bigger support, I think, in the country. Look, whenever I speak to people, you know, many people are not familiar with the case. I mean, believe it or not, some people haven't even ever heard of Julian Assange, incredibly. But when you explain the kind of basic detail, I mean, people are absolutely shocked and appalled and outraged. You know, and if the media did half their job, as we've seen them whipping up hysteria over Ukraine, if they'd spoken about the outrage that is being done in our name to Julian Assange, well, I think there would be a similar outcry.
Yeah, it's interesting,
because it's
isn't
absolutely
it?
Disgraceful.
It was actually Laura Smith, I think she was, on RT, that did one of the seminal interviews with Julian Assange before he was being put into the Ecuadorian embassy. And, I mean, it still stands up to this day. One of the things Julian said in that, Chris, was that the only ways that war start is because of the media lies.
And his
mission was to make sure the media wasn't allowed to lie to bring us into another war.
No, absolutely. I mean, he said they were basically culpable war criminals, effectively. I mean, yes, he said, you know, look, if wars could be started with lies, we can start peace with truth. And, and he was a truth teller. And that's clearly is unacceptable.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those kind of litmus test issues, really, isn't it? You know, people are kind of, if you do know about Julian, it's like chalk and cheese. There's not the both sides will not really ever agree with each other. But anyway, look, getting back to the sort of how we fix all this, We had quite a success with Nigel Farage. He was a very marginal sort of character, didn't have any MPs, Chris, and yet he managed to have an enormous amount of influence when it came to the Brexit vote. He basically used his influence to force the Tory party to adopt certain policies. I wonder, do you think that there's any possibility of something similar happening with the left in that some of these characters such as Ken Livingstone, Jeremy, yourself, getting together to pull a party together that can start to have a bit of an influence? Because the thing is, Starmer and his party isn't really representing most people on the left. They are almost like a kind of Trojan horse in there. And all surely that needs to happen is that those policies are put forward and that these people are shamed. And you could potentially have, an influence, if not a burgeoning and growing party.
Well, that's certainly what we're trying, and we have to attempt to do that. It's more difficult for us, of course, because the thing about Nigel Farage was that he was, bankrolled by incredibly, wealthy, powerful vested interests. We don't have that luxury. But the point I always make to people, I used to make this point when I naively thought that the Labour Party was a vehicle for progressive social change in this country, is that the working class, whilst individually we've got no power and we haven't got money, and the reason that the powerful elites have got power is because they have plenty of brass, they've got plenty of money, and they use that to protect their power, enhance their power. But we've got power when we stand together, when we link arms through solidarity, through that strength of solidarity, collective action. That's how we can exercise power.
And is there any way to translate that into electoral success? Even if it's not an immediate success, it might take a while.
Well, we have to try. Look, and I'm involved in the resist movement. I helped to found that. It's still a small acorn at the moment. Members have said they want to register as a political party. So that's a step which is now being taken. But I don't think that we will say that. Well, I know we won't then say, well, look, it's our way or the highway. I mean, we still then have to collaborate. And one of the main reasons that I founded the resist movement was to try and be the glue to bring the progressive left together, because one of the things that's killed the left over the years is the ability to fall out with each other. And don't underestimate the role of the state in fermenting that. We know from the Spycock revelations what the state is capable of, and so it's certainly in the state's interest. It's in the vested interests of the powerful elites in this country, to not have a unified left. And I think with Jeremy, it seemed that the Labour Party was going to be the vehicle for that. That's, as we were saying earlier, what frightened the living daylights out of them, and they did their level best to sabotage it and succeeded. And if we start to make some progress outside the Labour Party, then we will see a repetition, I think, of a similar sort of tactic. They will stop at nothing. There are no depths to which they will not stoop to undermine and to divide us. And we have to try and fight against that. I think that with the goodwill, I think we can do it. We're working with the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition that was established by Bob Crowe, the late great Bob Crowe, former leader of the RMT, the Transport Union, Rail Workers Union, and they're registered as a political party. We'll return. We resist as a seat on the steering committee there. We'll continue to work with them. We've collaborated with the Workers' Party. George Galloway got a very good vote in the Batley and Spen by-election. I think he had the potential to win there. Sadly, didn't quite make it. I think if we could start to get one or two breakthroughs, and that could open a floodgate. But look, politics shouldn't be just simply about electing good people and sending them off to Parliament. That route, I think, is the road to perdition, in my view. And what we need is a twin-track approach. And I think we need to look to examples around the globe, and particularly Latin America. And the most recent example, which I've often cited recently, is the one of Bolivia, where Evo Morales had won a landslide election, actually, but was kicked out with a US-backed coup. He was removed from office at the point of a gun. They then started to impose, neoliberalism. The IMF got involved and all the rest of it. But look, the movement towards socialism, it's known in Bolivia, were not prepared to accept that. And they essentially brought the country to a standstill. It was a trade union movement working with civil society. People lost their lives, actually, in Bolivia as well. Let's not forget that. But through that collective action, that strength of purpose, that unwillingness to accept the, you know, the oligarchs, to accept the kind of neoliberal doctrine as handed down from Washington, they forced the coup administration to hold new elections, and the socialists came back with an even bigger majority. But the trick was to have a movement in the country, a social movement. You know, the thing that Jeremy talked about, building a social movement, that's what we need to focus on. It's not about, you know, sending, I mean, clearly there's a role for that, but it's got to be more than that. I mean, one of the reasons I was going around the country to promote democracy inside the Labour Party was to put people on notice. I wasn't being melodramatic when I said this, but I made the point that if we get Jeremy elected and we start to implement this kind of, actually, it was a relatively modest agenda, but anyway, you know, it was radical in the context of the last 40 years, socialist agenda, particularly the anti-imperialist agenda, there would be huge attempts made by the establishment to stop us. And you may remember, not long after Jeremy was elected as leader, a serving general went on record saying that they wouldn't tolerate a Corbyn-led Labour government cutting defence spending, withdrawing from NATO and scrapping Trident. And he said, and I'm quoting him now, that they would use fair means or foul to prevent this. This man, in my view, was talking about treason. But that was a level of power that we were confronting. And I was making the point as I went around the country, talking about obviously democratizing the Labour Party. But the point I was making over and above that was that we will need, if we get a Labour government elected, if we get Jeremy into 10 Downing Street, we will need a movement on the street to defend that Labour government. I absolutely believe that that was the case. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're probably aware of the, you know, Harold Wilson, you know, there was serious talk about a coup to overthrow Harold Wilson and to, you know, put in an administration, you know, there that with the Lord Mountbatten, I think, as a sort of stand-in.
Yes, apparently the Queen Mum, Chris, said when she was asked about it, said, "Oh no, dears, that would never do," and so they had to tone things down a little bit. Isn't it interesting who really runs the show? So
yes, indeed.
There was a lot of bugging and burgling went on, and Wilson was forced out of office. He then went to a couple of excellent journalists in those days at the BBC who'd done a documentary about South Africa. And he was in the middle of recording a documentary about the way he'd been forced out with them when they turned up at work one Monday at Television Centre to find all of their equipment and all their notes and all the recordings that they had already done disappeared, and the locks changed on their office, and a little note on there saying, "You're not, services are no longer required." So I mean, that's the way they dealt with that one. But look, nowadays we look, the actual long and short of what's going on in Ukraine and the general mismanagement of the economy means that we've now got 100% doubling of standing charges right across the country. We've also got 50% addition to most people's gas and electricity bills, many people more as well, and this is going to massively hit, you know, the certainly the poor, but, you know, the poorest third or half of the country is going to be hammered by this. And it's going to leave people simply with not enough money to make ends meet. It's going to force potentially millions into poverty, all of those who are the least able to afford it, Chris. So what policies have you got and what ideas have you got to sort things out?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, there's already 14 million people in poverty already. And I think this could be a kind of a poll tax moment, actually, when these huge fuel bills land on people's doormats. But look, I mean, it won't, in my opinion, potentially could not just simply be a big increase in fuel costs, but also, you know, blackouts. I mean, we may not just have shortages of food as well. And this could be the trigger. You never know. I mean, kind of, you know, was it Harold Macmillan talked about events, dear boy, you know, but My answer is what we were talking about under Jeremy, and what I was talking about when I was, you know, touring the country on the Democracy Roadshow. It's the democratisation of the economy, you know, bringing, if you like, bringing the commanding heights of the economy into sort of public ownership, but not just some great state monolith, but something which is much more democratically
accountable. Renationalisation, surely you need a lot of money to do that, don't you? Where are you going to get that?
Well, money's no object for a start in this country, as I was saying, I think, a little bit earlier on in our conversation, because we have our own sovereign currency. But you'd come to an arrangement, I'm sure, with the companies that, you know, that own these assets. I mean, they've ripped us off for so long, and I'm sure we would find an accommodation with them. But money is no object. The availability of money is not a problem in a country that has its own sovereign currency. The only the barrier, if you like, or the only impediment to public spending, because anything that's for sale in pound sterling, you know, we can just create the money. It's just a treasury official pressing a few keys in the treasury, and you create that money. So that's not a problem. The thing you need to be mindful of course is potential for inflation, but you can address that. The issue is really, do we have the capacity for, you know, a big spend, a big improvement in public spending, a big increase in public spending? Well, we do have the capacity, don't we, in the economy? There's lots of spare capacity. We've got well over a million people officially unemployed. Millions and millions more are underemployed in this country. We've got a massive crisis in terms of our public services. There's a social care crisis in our country. We've got an infrastructure crisis in our country. We have an education crisis, it seems to me, in our country. We need to be renewing our schools. We need to be increasing the number of teachers. Why do we have a pupil-teacher ratio of, 30, 35 to 1? Why isn't it the same as it is in the public schools? We can have all of these things. It's just about political will. Money is no object, as I say. We can just create that money. And if the economy is up to capacity, and so that there's then not the spare capacity, if you like, for this additional public expenditure, well, you can then use the tax system to create the space to tax out some of the private, if you like, private sector spend, to create the space for this additional public sector to do these, public works that you want to see, create a good society. And there's lots of things that need to be done. The adaptation to the climate crisis. We should be, in my opinion, replanting the uplands of Britain. That would create a massive number of jobs, and it would also help us in terms of dealing with the extreme weather events and hold the excess rainwater that we're getting for longer, and enable the water courses to cope with the release of that water. Which would be released more steadily if you had more trees on the uplands than is happening at the moment, which is just coming down, then it's being washed away, and we're seeing the terrible consequences of that downstream. So there's loads of things that need to be done, improving our railways and so on. So lots of work needs to be done, and it was John Maynard Keynes who said, I think he made a speech in 1930, almost 100 years ago, when he said, "My grandchildren, i.e. our generation, will only be working 15 hours a week because of the advance of new technology." Well, we've seen new technology, but we haven't seen the benefits of it. And one of the things I was also arguing, and still do argue, is that we should become 21st century Luddites, because all the Luddites wanted to do was to ensure that the new technology of their era wasn't used to put them into penury. It was, they were saying, new technology should be our servant, not our master. That same applies today. And with political will, we can do all of these things. So look, money is not a problem. So bringing these things into public ownership, which I think is an absolute must, in my opinion. I mean, you look, at the colossal profits and dividends that the privatized utilities have shelled out. And I mean, it's eye-watering, the monies which have gone into the pockets of the super rich at our expense. So, we should be doing all of these things, but so that would be our, that would be our sort of way of dealing with this, a democratization in it, democratize the economy, make it work for the many, not the few.
Well, that sounds great, Chris, but so how long until we get an electable resist candidate that we can vote for at a general election, please?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. As they say, we're in the process of registering as a political party. Hopefully we'll be in a position to have some candidates in place. But as I say, I mean, I think we need to take a lesson from like Syriza in Greece. I know they went wrong, but I mean, their initial success was because they brought radical left socialist groups together. It was a coalition. Same with Podemos in Spain. And indeed, in Latin America, if you look in Latin America, where they've been successful, you know, they brought the left together. You know, they brought socialist left together. And that's the secret for success, I think. I don't think, you know, if Resist becomes a political party, that will be the magic fix, as it were. It will be part of the mix. The key thing is coming together, is collaborating. And yes, there will be areas where we disagree, but there's many, many, many things where we will agree. And let's focus on that. And that's why, you know, we went up and we campaigned rigorously for George Galloway in Batley and Spen by-election, why we went and campaigned for Dave Nellis in the Erdington by-election. Sadly, Dave didn't get the same return as George did. There are some lessons, I think, that we could have taken from the Batley and Spen campaign, which might have improved Dave's return. But Dave did still come third. I mean, beat the Liberal Democrats, beat the Greens. You know, he was sort of, you know, he was the top of the rest of the field, as it were. I mean, it was, you know, we have this unfair electoral system, this first past the post electoral system in this country, which obviously favours the Tories and the Labour Party.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you see, Farage, he successfully got round that by getting a media presence. So he had a lot of support, direct support from Rupert Murdoch himself.
Well, that's the point. And that's the point I was making, though. It was easier for him. I'm not sort of, making excuses, but they had that support in the media that we won't have. They had access to billionaires' monies, which we won't have.
Yeah, the right tends to be a little bit more disciplined and it sounds to me like you've got a bit of a job herding cats on the left. Anyway, look, good luck with all that, Chris. And how listeners follow what you're up to, not just you, but these left movement generally?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, social media, I mean, Tusk has a presence there, as a presence. I mean, if you just kind of go onto Twitter, it's TUS Coalition. So Tusk Coalition, as it were, at TUS Coalition, you'll find them. MFA, People's Party, that's ourselves, Movement for a People's Party. Resist Movement for a People's Party. I'm at Darby Chris W, at Darby Chris W on Twitter. And then if people can find that, then there's links to the websites on the Twitter profiles and so on. But I was, and indeed, obviously, the Workers' Party as well, another good party, and do some great things in my view, you know, and they've got some really good people involved in it, some very senior trade unionists who are active in the and hold senior positions in the Workers' Party. We held a very successful Festival of Resistance last year, actually, in Nottingham, and we hope to organise another one this year where we brought the left together. You know, we brought the Workers' Party, the Socialist Party, Trade Union and Socialist Coalition were at that meeting. We had speakers from around the world, you know, from liberation movements. We had people speaking about modern monetary theory. You know, we'd got Bill Mitchell, you know, the godfather of modern monetary theory. We had a range of different pressure groups, active pressure groups, people like Palestine Action were there, the Orgreave Truth and Justice Campaign were there, the Extinction Rebellion were there, Insulate Britain, you know, the people that were blocking the M25 and so on, saying, look, we need to do more to address this climate crisis and fuel poverty in this country. You need to be engaged. And that's another thing that we should be doing. You know, we should be insulating everybody's domestic dwelling, as well as commercial premises, all these things that, you know, that should be done. But we had those pressure groups there. We had political groups there. We had speakers, as I say, from around the world. People like Avi Martin spoke at the meeting from the US. Max Blumenthal, obviously from the Grey Zone. Avi Martin from the Empire Files. If people have seen them, if they're not, it's certainly well worth looking them up as well. And we hope to do that again this year, later this year. And, you know, the idea is, as I say, is to kind of bring people together from across the left to look at how we can collaborate, how we can work better together, and, okay, and how look, we can Chris, inspire, Chris. How we can reach out to the wider general public.
Chris, look, final question on Ukraine. How long is it going to last, do you think, and what will the eventual outcome be? Because a lot of people coming up with all sorts of different potentials for this one.
I think it'll be over fairly soon, actually. I think the Russian forces are overwhelming the Ukrainian forces from what I'm hearing on the ground. Not something that we get too much coverage, if any coverage at all, on the corporate media. It seems that the negotiations now, Zelensky seems to have acknowledged that that NATO membership is not an option. I think that's all that Russia really wants, actually, in the end. A neutral Ukraine and recognition for the Luhansk and Donetsk regions of the country. I mean, I think there is an issue about the influence of the Nazis in the neo-Nazis in the country as well. But the Russians. It's terrible consequences, of course. And you think that none of this was necessary. All of it could have been avoided. But the United States have a lot to answer for in this. I mean, I think if Biden's administration were to intervene now, they could bring this conflict to an end tomorrow, in my opinion. So I'm hopeful that it will be over sooner rather than later. And I can't see it going on more than another week or two. But I could be proven wrong. I hope I'm not. I hope it comes to an end sooner than that. But let's see.
We all hope it's over sooner rather than later. Chris Williamson, former MP up in Derby, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries. Cheers.